where these total morons are just dismissing the greatest threat to human welfare there's ever been. You know, how else can you respond to it? And, you know, kudos to John for keeping his cool. I don't know how he did it, because I would have been bashing my head on the table that he was sitting at. Anyway, yes, so we're talking about total morons. We now have a race between Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak to grab the helm of the Titanic as it starts going down, the brackets the Conservative Party. You could not have two less suitable people for high office of any kind at all, let alone to be prime minister of this country. But they are going to be chosen not by the country as a whole, but by the members of the Conservative Party, who are about 200,000 people, mostly elderly, almost entirely white, mostly male, living in a very particular, prosperous part of the country. And so what these people have to do to become prime minister really is to appeal to the worst instincts of humanity. And that's how they win. And both of them are very well equipped to do that. Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak basically are, in concentrated form, the worst instincts of humanity. And they would be utterly devastating. I mean, we've had a terrible prime minister, the worst prime minister ever, perhaps, in the form of Boris Johnson. And it looks like they will continue that glorious tradition. Basically, what the Conservative Party in this country has become, now that it's been stripped of all moderating influences, is a channel for the demands of the most predatory and destructive forms of capital.
And let's just say the British Prime Minister is addressing Parliament, just said, Boris Johnson, hasta la vista, baby. Your last 5 seconds, George.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see the back of all of them. I mean, here we are, you know,
we have to leave this huge crisis. I'm sorry. Yeah. I made me a good move there.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's hospitals are struggling as a new pandemic wave sweeps in. A lawsuit challenges voting maps in Washington State, saying they dilute the power of Latino voters. And how Congress plans to revamp the Electoral Count Act in a way that would prevent another January 6th. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 21st, 2022. I am Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us tonight. The COVID pandemic continues hurting Oregon's hospitals. As KBOO's Josh Salem reports, available beds are few and far between.
COVID-19 hospitalizations in Oregon remain low, but hospitals in the state are still struggling. While that rate is less than half what it was at its peak last fall, a combination of factors, including financial struggles, a rising hospitalization rate, inability to transfer patients to long-term care facilities, and severe staffing shortages, have all decreased the number of available beds in some areas. In fact, even having physical beds available does not guarantee hospitals have the staff to use them. While no hospital in Oregon has been spared, Central and Southern Oregon have been especially hard hit. 96% of inpatient adult beds at St. Charles Medical Center in Bend were occupied on Tuesday. Last week, the hospital's chief medical officer, Doug Merrill, told providers to get ready for, quote, the hardest challenges we have seen in the last 2 years, end quote. Two St. Charles nurses allegedly told Oregon Public Broadcasting that working conditions have worsened recently, with many providers not able to take scheduled breaks and some working as long as 16 hours per day. Last week, St. Charles activated its Incident Command System, which aims to stabilize staffing and manage hospital admissions during emergent conditions. Yesterday, state data demonstrated only 7% of Oregon hospital beds were available. The situation seems as bad as it was during the Delta and Omicron waves of the pandemic in late 2021 and early 2022. Financial struggles have likely contributed to staff layoffs and elimination of vacant positions, worsening the crisis. Oregon hospitals lost a collective $103 million during the first quarter of 2022. Oregon is not the only state where hospitals are full. The Washington State Hospital Association reported many hospitals are at 120 to 130% capacity. While hospital bed availability is not clearly provided by Idaho, hospitalization rates have risen in high-risk COVID areas. In one county, patients with COVID occupied 10% of staff beds earlier this week. Oregon health officials are urging people in 21 counties with high rates of COVID, including the three Portland area counties, to return to wearing masks. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A jury has found one Patriot Prayer member guilty on a rioting charge. Mackenzie Lewis will be sentenced on August 1st. Prosecutors accused Lewis, Joey Gibson, and Russell Schultz of felony riot after a May 2019 brawl between the right-wing group and Antifa members outside a Northeast Portland cider bar. But a Multnomah County judge dismissed the charges against Russell and Gibson, who was the right-wing group's leader. The judge did not dismiss the rioting charge against Lewis. He cited evidence that Lewis picked up a canister and threw it and shoved a woman. A local judge will no longer preside over a case she'd been working on. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade explains why.
A Clackamas County judge who has presided over the ongoing case regarding Oswego Lakes public use access was disqualified from the proceedings on Tuesday due to communications she had while serving on the Oregon legislature in 2014. The disqualification was issued by Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Tom Ryan, citing Ann Leninger as potentially committing a due process violation when she met with plaintiffs Mark Kramer and Todd Prager while she held the House District 38 representative seat in 2014. Oregon law states a judge may not preside over a case if personal communications regarding the matter were previously conducted as a public official. Lawyers representing the Lake Oswego Corporation and the City of Lake Oswego are responsible for the push for disqualification following Leninger's initial ruling finding the lake's water open to public use. Kramer and Prager initially filed a suit in 2012 arguing that Oswego Lake's waters should be available for public recreation despite pushback from the community. After the case was appealed up to the Oregon Supreme Court, it ended up being sent back to Clackamas County for reconsideration, resulting in a two-part trial in 2019, which initially resulted in Leninger ruling in favor of the lake's waters falling under the, quote, public trust doctrine management, meaning that its waters belong to the public. During 2019's proceedings, Leninger refused to recluse herself, saying while she was an elected official, she had met with constituents on all sides regarding the case. Though Leninger did not sponsor legislature in favor of the plaintiffs after their meeting in 2014, she acknowledged that she had referred them to legislators who might be sympathetic to their plight. During Tuesday's hearing, Nadia Dahab, representing Leninger, maintained that the former lawmaker had not endorsed a bill Kramer and Prager had pushed for following their meeting, and thusly was not a participant. The Lake Corporation and the city disagreed, saying Leninger was sympathetic and responded favorably with Kramer and Prager, with Ryan ultimately siding with the defendants. As the saga for the waters of Lake Oswego continues, no dates have been set for subsequent proceedings. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Filipinos and their allies plan to hold a People's State of the Nation address rally this Sunday from 3:30 to 6:30 at Portland State University Park Blocks. They say they'll deliver a counter-response to Ferdinand Marcos Jr.'s State of the Nation address and talk about concerns of fraudulent elections they say put him in power this past May. Copeland Downs, a member of the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines, says massive vote buying and voter harassment is not new to the Philippines, but the return of the Marcos family to the highest position in the land should alarm everyone. Many in the Oregon Filipino community say Marcos will continue human rights violations and uphold outgoing President Duterte's legacy, including his infamous drug war. An affordable housing expert from Oregon tells members of the U.S. Senate that the pandemic has made America's housing crisis worse. Andrea Bell is the executive director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Here's part of what she said to the Senate Finance Committee, where she spoke at the request of Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden.
We serve as the state of Oregon's housing finance agency. First off, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your steadfast leadership for many years and continuously elevating the needs of the people of Oregon and their housing needs collectively. Senator Crapo, I also want to acknowledge and just uplift your support for affordable housing. Your leadership certainly does not go unnoticed. For years, our nation has not built enough rental housing. But the conditions and circumstances spurred by the pandemic have made our housing crisis particularly acute, to which individuals with low incomes, individuals and families with moderate incomes, are bearing the brunt of that impact. With rising interest rates, escalating home prices, skyrocketing rents due to the mismatch between supply and demand, many would-be homeowners are often left stuck renting. And more than 70% of extremely low-income renters across the United States spend more than half of their income on housing in 2021. 70%. That 70% of individuals that have to make tough decisions every single month throughout the year about what bills they'll be able to pay and how they are going to get by. The housing credit and housing bonds are by far the most essential production tools that we have at our disposal. Affordable housing simply relies on these programs. The housing credit specifically is a highly successful both public and private partnership. And what we know is when we stabilize individuals and stabilize families, we also stabilize communities, which has an economic benefit. In the state of Oregon, nearly 70% of all rental homes financed in the last 5 years relied on bonds. Costs are increasing due to inflation, supply chain disruptions, many things that I know that members of this committee are fully aware of. Housing finance agencies and our partners across the nation are doing everything that we can to prevent deals from falling through. But the unfortunate reality is that sometimes financing gaps are simply too large, and in some cases, there are no resources to pull from to help cure those financing gaps. The most impactful thing that Congress can do is to pass the Senator Cantwell and Young's Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act. It would both expand and strengthen the housing credit. It would significantly increase the housing credit authority, allowing us to build more properties like Riverbend Place in rural Ontario, Oregon. The Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act would also provide states greater flexibility to spread existing bond resources to more developments by reducing the bond financing tests from 50% to 25%. I also urge Congress to pass the Bipartisan Lifeline Act introduced by Senators Leahy and Collins. This bill would enable states and localities to most effectively use federal fiscal recovery funds to fill financing gaps in housing credit developments. I also quickly want to mention two pieces of legislation that the Finance Committee should take up on means of homeownership. Senator Cortez Masto's Affordable Housing Bond Enhancement Act would enact simple and impactful improvements to the mortgage revenue bond and mortgage credit certificate programs, which are essential to serving low and moderate first-time home buyers. This is, again, creating pathways to home ownership, the dream that many of us have. Senators Cardin and Portman's Neighborhood Homes Investment Act would establish a new tax credit modeled after the highly successful housing credit. Now, simply put, the housing crisis simply will not get better if Congress does not act. In my last few seconds, I would just urge both and elevate my appreciation for this committee, and we need Congress to act. The action is going to come post this committee and what decisions we'll be able to make in service to the American people. I appreciate the time.
Well said, Ms. Bell. Thank you.
That was Andrea Bell, the Executive Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Results from a survey earlier this week reveal that most City of Portland employees who work remotely would likely quit if required to return to in-office operations full-time. Nearly 3,500 responded to the survey, with 64% working hybrid schedules and just under 10% working exclusively remote. Responses from those working hybrid schedules are showing 34% would consider looking for alternative employment if the city required more than one day of in-office duties, and that 64% would do the same if more than 2 days were required. Of the remote employee sector, 38% said they would look for other jobs if any on-site work was required, and 73% saying they will likely quit if more than one day of in-office activity was required. Both elected city officials and local business leaders have urged city workers to return to in-office duties in efforts to support and revitalize retailers and restaurants staggered by the COVID-19 closures. In May, the city and the Portland Business Alliance drummed up an initiative called Downtown Workers Are Here for Portland to encourage spending in the stricken area. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler has continually rallied for workers returning, saying it is critical to the health of the urban core. According to the survey, city employees do not share that sentiment, citing concerns over workplace and downturn safety issues, rising transportation costs, COVID-19 outbreaks, and microaggressions experienced by people of color and LGBTQIA+ employees. Overall, survey results are showing that city workers feel they should not be seen as a tool for downtown economic stimulus, and that workplace decisions should remain flexible. The Washington voting map lawsuit in Yakima Valley won't affect November's elections. The Washington State Redistricting Commission approved a new legislative map in 2021. The lawsuit is challenging legislative redistricting in the Yakima Valley, saying it dilutes the votes of people of Latino heritage. However, as Eric Tegedoff reports, the lawsuit is set to go on trial in 2023 after the midterm election.
A lawsuit challenging Washington State's new legislative voting map is underway, but it won't affect this year's primary or midterm elections. The suit alleges the Washington State Redistricting Commission's state map in the Yakima Valley dilutes votes for the region's growing population of Washingtonians of Latin heritage. Ernest Herrera is the Western Regional Council with Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, which is part of the lawsuit.
This map was drawn in a manner that creates what we call a facade district, meaning it is a district that is meant to appear to give Latinos an opportunity to elect, but does not actually give them an opportunity to elect candidates of their choice.
District 15, the district in question, has a Latino voting population of 50.02%, and the suit alleges cuts out heavily Latino populations in cities such as Yakima and Toppenish. The commission said it didn't want to split up the Yakima reservation, which is in the 14th district. But Herrera says the map resulted in a racial gerrymandering. He says even if it wasn't intentional, it's a violation of the Federal Voting Rights Act, which lays out what is required in redistricting.
Minorities are entitled to a district where they are sufficiently numerous, meaning eligible voters, where there is racially polarized voting, meaning the majority group, usually white people, votes in opposition to whoever the minority group wants, and where there is a history of discrimination.
Herrera adds that this also has an effect on the people who live in the region.
Beyond the law, beyond the federal law, here you have Latinos in the Yakima Valley region and Pasco who are trying to elect representatives who are going to improve their lives and represent them in state government and in local government.
Herrera says the trial is scheduled to begin next January, although the state of Washington has filed a motion to push the date back at least 6 months. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Meantime, as we continue to focus on voting rights, some groups say anti-democracy candidates could gain seats in Idaho's legislature. In the 2022 Republican primary, 8 incumbent senators lost and 13 current senators didn't run. This means candidates on the far right are likely to have much more power in the Idaho legislature after the November election. So some groups in Idaho are warning about these candidates' anti-democracy views.
Far-right candidates made inroads in Idaho's Republican primary and likely will have seats in the state legislature after November's election. but some groups in Idaho say these candidates have not shown an affinity for democracy. Tony Stewart is a longtime human rights activist in North Idaho. He says some extreme candidates lost on the statewide level and in eastern Idaho, but won seats in four Senate races in the Panhandle, along with local offices down ballot. He says folks with extreme views also have attended and disrupted local government meetings.
It's very, very intense, and it's very hard to have dialogue in those kinds of situations.
Stewart says while fringe candidates have been successful in many parts of North Idaho, they still struggle to win elections in Coeur d'Alene. He also notes that traditional Republicans are fighting back against the far right, such as the organization Take Back Idaho. The group is headed by Jim Jones, the former Republican Attorney General and Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. Idaho Senate leadership says these concerns are exaggerated and that more moderate candidates will stay in charge. Adrian Evans is head of the organization United Vision for Idaho. She says the far-right candidates have espoused anti-democracy ideas and have selfish goals in mind.
They don't believe in America. They don't believe in democracy. They want to see it fail because that failure solidifies power in the hands of a very small minority of people who hate people who are different than them and want to preserve white power.
Another threat to democracy is the so-called big lie, in which people have claimed without evidence that the results of the 2020 election were fraudulent. Stewart says that narrative even reached red states such as Idaho, where there were post-election audits in more than a half dozen counties.
It's amazing to have it because the margin was very large for the Republicans, but in their audit, it proved that there was no fraud in the election. The results are almost identical.
Evans says extremists pose a threat to everyone in Idaho.
We need to be really clear that this is something that's being waged on all of us, Democrat, Republican alike. This is really about democracy.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, Hard Knock Radio. Then at 8, Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy skies, a low down at 59. Tomorrow's weather, morning clouds give way to sunshine for the afternoon, a high of 78. For the weekend, partly cloudy, the heat climbs to 81 Saturday and a higher 91 Sunday. Today in history, on this date in 1925, the trial of the century drew national attention. Schoolteacher John Snopes was convicted of violating Tennessee's law against teaching evolution in public schools. A former congressman, William Jennings Bryan, took over the prosecution, and Clarence Darrow served as the defense attorney. The quote of the day is from Clarence Darrow. I am pleading for the future. I am pleading for a time when hatred and cruelty will not control the hearts of men, when we can learn by reason and judgment and understanding and faith that all life is worth saving and that mercy is the highest attribute of man. Amid an historic drought affecting the West, some advocates are slamming a conservation plan to save water. New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah are proposing a plan that activists deride as meaningless. Suzanne Potter spoke to the director of the nonprofit Save the Colorado.
Water conservation groups are speaking out against a plan from the states of New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah to divert less water from the Colorado River. The so-called Upper Basin states sent a letter this week to the Federal Bureau of Reclamation laying out a 5-point plan. But Gary Walkner with the nonprofit Save the Colorado says the proposal would mostly preserve the status quo, which has led to historic low water levels at Lake Mead.
You know, this is not a good faith effort, and I think it probably should just infuriate the Lower Basin and the people of Nevada, because the Upper Basin states are not taking it seriously.
The letter complains that water users in the Upper Basin states already suffer chronic shortages, but it agrees to extend a program that pays farmers to use less water. The feds are requiring the 7 states that depend on the Colorado River to reduce usage by 20% to 30% in 2023, 2 to 4 million acre feet of water. The Southern Nevada Water Authority did not provide a response by deadline. Walkner notes that the feds threaten to impose a solution if the western states don't agree on a workable plan.
And then they said even further, we have the authority to do it ourselves, and so you either do it or we will do it to you. But this is a historic phenomenon where the federal government is saying that they have the authority to protect those dams and protect the hydropower plants, make sure everything keeps running.
Nevada has been ramping up water restrictions, banning non-functional grass starting in 2026. And just this week, Las Vegas restricted the size of new residential pools. Finally, now through the end of August, the Southern Nevada Water Authority has banned watering between 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday or at any time on Sundays.
Congress plans to revamp the Electoral Count Act. Merrick Garland says no one is above the law. The mayor of Highland Park calls for an assault weapons ban. And the Ukrainian First Lady makes an impassioned plea. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
The confusing and antiquated language that we have on the books today from the 1887 Electoral Count Act is a real and present danger to our democracy. We can fix that.
Led by West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin and Maine Republican Susan Collins, a bipartisan group of senators introduced legislation to reform the Electoral Count Act. The measure clarifies the vice president has a strictly ceremonial role during the certification of presidential election results. The vagueness of the original law was exposed when congressional supporters of former President Donald Trump attempted to overturn results in five states. The Secret Service is starting to turn over records in response to a January 6th committee subpoena seeking deleted text messages. The agency is accused of violating federal records laws by failing to preserve data. During primetime tonight, the committee will outline Trump's actions on January 6th. When asked about the possibility of Trump facing charges, Attorney General Merrick Garland said no person is above the law.
There is nothing in the principles of prosecution, in any other factors, which prevent us from investigating anyone. Anyone who's criminally responsible for an attempt to undo a Democratic election.
In a new lawsuit, a Democratic group claims the Federal Election Commission has failed to investigate Trump's hints he will run for president in 2024. The group alleges the former president is attempting to sidestep federal election laws. Now to the Senate, where mass shootings were discussed in a committee hearing. Texas Republican John Cornyn argued gun restrictions aren't the answer.
What does matter is the person possessing that firearm, and certainly our focus has been keeping them out of the hands of people with criminal records and people with mental health problems.
However, the mayor of Highland Park, Illinois, Nancy Rotering, called for an assault rifle ban in her testimony about the July 4th parade massacre.
We know that there are mental health issues in other countries throughout this world. We know that there are troubled people who are inclined towards violence. What's the differentiating factor? Combat weapons and access to civilians. There's no place for these weapons.
On Wednesday, members of Congress also heard from the First Lady of Ukraine, Olena Zelenska.
Russia is destroying our people.
Zelenska specifically asked for air defense systems that can intercept Russian missiles and thanked Congress for the tens of billions of dollars in assistance it's already provided. The Senate advanced legislation to provide billions in assistance to the U.S. semiconductor industry. The CHIPS measure is a scaled-back attempt to improve competitiveness with China. And as expected, President Biden announced new steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Climate change is an emergency, and in the coming weeks, I'm going to use the power I have as president to turn these words into formal, official government actions.
Initiatives include investments in programs to protect communities from flooding and help cover heating and cooling costs for low-income families. I'm Mary Sherman.
A new study shows most Americans' hearts are not in good shape. The study shows the average cardiovascular health score out of a possible 100 was 64.7 for adults and 65.5 for children. Mike Mohn reports that personal habits are a factor, but experts say that people lacking access to preventative care is another important reason.
Good heart health is associated with avoiding a range of medical issues, but new research shows only 1 in 5 Americans has optimal cardiovascular health. South Dakota's medical community says there's a lot of complexities when considering prevention. This summer's new study, appearing in the journal Circulation, used the American Heart Association's new Life's Essential 8 scoring system. It found that 80% of adults landed at a low or moderate level. Dr. Dave Kapaska is a retired executive from Avera McKennan Hospital in Sioux Falls. He says providers face a challenge in motivating patients to embrace healthier lifestyles, but he adds there are other things beyond a person's control.
Genetically, there certainly are socioeconomic realities that occur, and all of these things fold together to make it a very complex, interrelated challenge.
Kapaska volunteers with the AHA as part of a broader coalition to expand Medicaid in South Dakota. The question goes before voters this fall. Supporters say closing the insurance coverage gap gap allows marginalized residents to seek preventative care visits. Opponents, including Governor Kristi Noem, cite cost concerns and liken the issue to providing an entitlement to able-bodied individuals.
The issue of Inuit food security is a topic for ICC delegates, and Montana's Indigifest celebrates Native products. With these stories and more, here's today's edition of National Native News.
The Inuit Circumpolar Council is holding its General Assembly this week. On Wednesday, delegates from the ICC's four member nations heard a report on how the organization has addressed food security among Inuit communities over the last 4 years. Emily Schwing reports.
The ICC is a non-governmental organization that represents more than 180,000 Inuit across the Arctic, including in Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Chukotka in the Russian Far East. Natan Obed is the head of Canada's delegation.
We have some of the highest rates of food insecurity in the world, between 60 and 70% in each of our Inuit regions. And we know that we need to do much more to ensure that Inuit have enough food to eat.
The delegations from Alaska and Canada developed the Food Sovereignty and Self-Governance Project to examine and better understand food sovereignty issues. The Alaskan delegation's cultural sustainability advisor, Verne Ognabugak, presented findings from the project to the ICC.
The Food Sovereignty and Self-Governance Project builds upon the recommendation from the Food Security Report, where authors noted that a key threat to our food security is the lack of decision-making power and management.
Vivian Cortuis is the head of Alaska's ICC delegation. She noted that a changing climate has a heavy impact on food system security.
We are seeing immense changes in the oceans and on our rivers and in our land and weather. Our animals in the regions that we live in are changing. They're moving around differently. We have experienced salmon crashes in our region, and the impact of that is not just 1 or 2 years.
The ICC holds a general assembly every 4 years. Because this year's meeting format is a hybrid in-person and virtual meeting due to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, leadership has opted to report on the progress made since its last meeting in 2018. Alaska will hand over its chairmanship to Greenland at the close of this year's meeting. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing.
Native American businesses and Indigenous artists recently showcased their work in Billings, Montana. Yellowstone Public Radio's Kayla DeRoche went to the first Big Sky Indigifest, where one business owner talked about Native American-made products.
I love sweet grass.
Chippewa Cree tribal member Luann Belcourt holds up a C-shaped braid of dried grass tied at each end.
We grow it in... We use sweetgrass every morning to pray. This is my favorite.
Belcourt and her daughters run Creations, selling items like